Hello, everybody, and welcome to the next edition of News from a Boring Dystopia. This is Antonio and Bruno.
What's up, guys?
How have things been going, Bruno, over in Brazil? I was hearing you telling me that you were not feeling super well. How has that been going?
Yeah, I got COVID-19. Yeah. One more number to the statistics. So I'm not actually like got a real proof about it. I'm just waiting because it takes 7 days till the result comes out because I did the, like, they call the swab test, which is like put a straw inside your nose and like a, do a little twist or something to catch all the, I don't know, the substance they want to analyze. And I mean, the four first days was like the worst. I was very tired. A lot of headaches, fever, and like a sweating. I was like sweating all the time. It's really weird. And then after the four first days, I lost my olfact, my ability to smell things. And that's very weird because, I mean, the previous day was like normal. And then the day after it, I was like taking a shower and I wasn't feeling the smell of the shampoo or the soap or something. And I said, I think it's already happened. And then all the days after it, I was like a taste and note type of food, and all the food tastes the same for me. It was terrible. But one thing, even though I can't taste anything, I still crave like chocolate and candy. And when I eat them, I don't feel any type of like special flavor, but I still feel like satisfied because I killed my craving. That's weird, right? It's more a psychological thing, I don't know.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting story. I knew that I felt like I got COVID. It's kind of a funny story. It's kind of like a political correctness story. I was in Portland, Oregon in a co-living space because I was working in Portland at the time. And, you know, Oregon. And it's a co-living space. So there's lots of people living together, which was, you know, it used to be okay to do that before COVID. And then it was just a few weeks ever since it became big news. And then there was this group of sick Chinese girls that came into the house. They were all from China. And they were coughing like crazy. And I was like,
racist, but
I want to be racist, but they're coughing like crazy. And they're all from China. What's going on with this? So I was like, I didn't want to say anything because it was like, that's like, I was stuck in like a catch-22 where I was like, to the owners, you can't like say, well, they are sick and they're from China. You can't kick them out because I think that's against the law. But it was just like,
yeah.
After that, I immediately left and then I came back to California. Okay, so now that we're back, Bruno was interested in having some discussions about some current events. We were moving a little bit more philosophical, but I think if we do a little bit of both, the news as well as some philosophical discussions, I think that would be for the best. So I brought some news articles that I thought were kind of interesting. Obviously, a lot has happened in this week beyond just, you know, one thing that happened just yesterday or very recently was this beheading that happened in Paris.
Yeah, so Robespierre is back.
Yeah, it was not the 1% being guillotined. It was unfortunately a teacher. And according to this article, let me see, by The Independent, which is what I'm reading, a history teacher was stabbed and decapitated in front of his school in a suspected terror attack in near Paris, according to the police. The victim had shown caricatures of Islam's prophet Muhammad to students during a lesson earlier this month, officials said. And so France's anti-terrorism prosecutor is out trying to, you know, get on the scene. And the attacker was shot dead minutes later by the police, which, you know, is pretty, that's good. But the, you know, this is basically like a big headline. And I don't know, what do you think about that, Bruno, with regards to, you know, obviously you want to be respectful of religion, religious views to some degree, but It's just like, I think that obviously this is uncalled for. You don't subject people to your same laws as, you know, especially if they're like from a different culture, you know, with regards to like beheading someone. I don't think I feel like it's also probably true that a lot of these countries don't do that generally either. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about this tragedy?
Yeah, the teacher was trying to explain about freedom of speech and the importance of this, but unfortunately he used the worst example ever, because in the Islamic culture, you can't portray the Prophet Muhammad or any type of, saint or holy thing. So picturing a drowning of the Prophet, that was a bad choice of teaching this type of subject. But it doesn't justify be beheading and decapitated in front of the school, because you have to think that decapitate someone is not an easy thing to do. He was like, it took time for him to do this. So I don't know. I think the teacher was unhappy to put the example. I don't know if it was like a, how can I say it? A parody of actions. Like, okay, it's offensive to my religion to portray the Muhammad, the prophet image, but at the same time, you behead someone because of this. It's very serious matter, because if a radical Christian, be offended because the way they portrayed Jesus was wrong and started to decapitate someone because of this. It's a very extreme thing to hear and to think. And I think the same way it should work to the Islamics or any other type of religion or political thinking.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think that the tragedy of this sensationalized kind of news article is that it plays into a narrative that's just factually not true. Like, if you look at the data with regards to crime rates throughout Europe, even with Muslim immigration, crime rates are still precipitously low. So it plays into this caricature of Muslim, you know, as Islamic beliefs as being kind of like backwards or being kind of like violent or tender.
No, yeah. And it gives the argument for people like racist or Islamophobic, because they say, especially in France, there's this theory, like a racist guy, I don't know the name of the theorist. Let me search the name of him. So called the, in French, it's called the Le Grand Déplacement, which would be like a large white genocide conspiracy theory. Says that indigenous white people from Europe would be like replaced by these other people that are coming from North Africa, Middle East. And people who believe in this, the name of the theorist is Renaud Camus. And he released a book in 2011 called Le Grand Replacement, or The Great Replacement. And this could be used as an argument for this kind of people to say, look what these lemmings are doing to our country, the home of the liberty of expression, Western values. I mean, see what this kind of people was doing with our schools as a teacher. We can't say everything we want. I mean, we're being like discriminated because we're not, I don't know, you know, this type of far right and fascist type of, I mean, argument who says that people, the problem is because of the Muslims in general, not because of this guy who's like totally intolerant.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I agree with that. So the one thing that I think that, you know, there's definitely a discussion in the United States right now, especially in California, about free speech and versus hate speech. And I do think that America could learn from European countries with regards to having some basic hate speech protections for, you know, like basically not advocating for, you know, killing minorities. If you were to like have these speech of like trying to incite direct violence to minorities. Like, I think that, you know, maybe for you, Bruno, that since you're not as super keen on like American far right conspiracy theorists, there's a conspiracy theorist called Alex Jones that I think abuses free speech and might be the kind of speech that is indirectly violent. Like during the Parkland shooting, which was a shooting, you know, a school shooting that happened in Florida, I think, Alex Jones would spread these conspiracy theories that the parents, you know, these children never existed or that they never died and they were just their child actors. This invited a lot of attacks against the parents. So it was through his free speech and through his misinforming people that he inspired violence against these parents who had just suffered the loss of their children from a mass shooter. So it's in those instances of misinforming and those instances of indirect calls to violence that I think the United States could definitely stand to, you know, have some stronger regulation. But I do think that when it comes to respecting people's religious views to the extent that you can't offend anyone, you kind of, I think that crosses the line. If you're drawing Muhammad, you're not necessarily advocating direct violence or even indirect violence against Muslims. You're just basically making fun of their religion, but not necessarily anyone in particular. So I do think that even if you do believe in hate speech laws, which I do believe we could move forward with that in the United States, I do think that something like this should definitely still be protected under free speech, you know, making fun of whatever you want to do, as long as it's not directly or indirectly causing, you know, advocating for violence to people that can't defend themselves. And I think that this is, you know, obviously a big problem. So there's the other piece of news, which I thought was kind of interesting as well. According to the Jerusalem Post, Trump is less trusted across advanced economies than President Xi. So the perceptions of China have gone pretty south fairly recently. There's a survey of 14 countries of where they were quizzed on how they viewed China. And 86% of people in Japan, 85% in Switzerland, 62% of Italians, and 63% of Spaniards viewed China as a very negative. They viewed it, the one that disliked them the most was Japan. And
yeah, they hate China.
They didn't like China, and they really didn't like Xi, you know. But, and most people had said, of these 14 countries, 61% said that they thought China had done a bad job of dealing with the outbreak. But the funny thing is that if you also looked at how these 14 countries that were polled viewed America and viewed President Trump, Trump actually scored even lower than President Xi to a large degree. People is not, you know, President Xi is not liked. So the funny, it's not like President Xi is liked more than Trump. They are both despised by the Western.
No, the matter is like the Trump is more hated than Xi. It's like this.
Exactly. So
they're be more beloved.
So I think that's kind of interesting. I think it was that.
But I got an opinion on it. I think Trump is more hated in this advanced economy because of the type of regime that exists in the United States. Because, I mean, Trump, everything Trump tells and speaks, the media has the total access to the information and can publish it, and people can see Trump more like raw, in a raw form. And what doesn't happen in China, because first, Xi is a very quiet guy, is not like a alarmist or more like a show off like Trump. And so she's more like a quiet one. But at the same time, China is more like a closed regime and not everything is being published. Not everything goes out from China. So probably there's pieces of information which people in the West doesn't know about it. So I think at the same time, there is like a kind of imbalance of access to information. I think people from the West has not that much access on information about Xi than they got about Trump.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So that might make things even worse then. If they don't have the full story and they still just like, and they still like Xi more than Trump, then that's even worse. That's unfortunate. But after that, the number of the week. I'm the only one to guess it. So let's see
how that Okay. The number of the week today is 6.
6. Okay, so...
You can try to figure it out across the show. I mean, throughout the show, you can...
Okay, I'm going to figure it out. That is with the newest season of BoJack Horseman came out.
No, it's not.
Okay, that's Will Smith defeats... Okay, no, that's not... The Apple Watch Series 6, no?
No.
Okay, and it's not the Apple Watch. Okay, I don't know. We'll come out. We'll discuss it at the end then. Okay, and then...
Just one thing. I mean, the information is totally different from all this type of categories of information. So it's not about technology. It's not about entertainment.
Okay, so that's some hints. I'm still not going to be able to guess it, but...
Yeah.
You were saying that you wanted to discuss your topic... Which one?
Is information politics, infopolitics.
Information politics.
Yeah. Especially in the USA regarding to the disinformation approach that other countries are throwing on the US. I mean, in October 7th, the US Justice Department claimed that it shut down almost 100 websites linked to the Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. And the next day, so October 8th, Facebook and Twitter have taken down more than a dozen suspicious political and state-backed groups in Iran, Russia, Cuba, Saudi Arabia, and Thailand. But why the matter? I mean, the U.S. election is approaching, and everybody remember what a disaster was the election 2016 regarding to the foreign influence in the American cyberspace. Instead of traditional weapons, Americans' adversaries has been spreading fake news about the coronavirus, political unrest, and election integrity. So beyond this electoral issue, the infospace is the one which has the power to shape the public opinion, perceptions, and trust regarding to the surrounding reality. So one of the biggest recent examples of this is the claim from Zhao Lingqin, I hope I spell it right, the spokesperson of the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He said the pandemic, today's pandemic, I mean the coronavirus one, was a bioweapon created by the United States Army that was released in Wuhan in 2019. So, I mean, foreign politics and foreign governments are using this type of disinformation to mold public opinion and stuff. And even the article that I was reading said that a journal in India that in the period of the Cold War that this newspaper was supporting the Soviet Union said that United States created HIV and was a weapon used by the United States government to kill people across the globe. And I mean, it took decades to the United States government to undo this thinking on people because this type of information was like ran across the globe and a lot of people started to believe that the United States really created the HIV and purposely infected people. So that thing is real, I mean. But what is ironic is that disinformation and infopolitics has been a national security concern since the Cold War, as I said, and more specifically since the Reagan administration. And that's the problem, because The playbook in the United States is following to deal with this type of matter is still molded according to this obsolete way of doing things. I mean, the Cold War era. Internet didn't even exist at the time. So there's a great problem because of two major issues. The first, the global media environment has become far more complex. I mean, differently from the past generations when people had few broadcast news outlets, today everybody can virtually create news and every piece of information palm of their hands. And two, the US adversaries have relied on internet bots and other type of stuff to amplify the content to advance the strategic objects. So it gets even more problematic since the United States is a democracy, so has a Bill of Rights, and all this doesn't let the government take whatever decisions. And added to that, we don't have a consensus about the data ethics. So a comprehensive countering disinformation strategy would be smart to recognize the limits of the government action, given the speed and scale which the information moves across social media today. And there are some alternatives to United States to cope this problem. One of the biggest methods is to overcome this encouraging effect fact-checking among social media platforms to tackle any misinformation spreading. Another method is the use of innovative investments on AI technologies through Defense Innovation Unit to identify fake images, video attacks, etc. And it showed that there should be a more coordination and cooperation among the private sector, especially from the one from the Silicon Valley to mobilize America's response to such a threat. But that's a problem because the Washington, the Pentagon, has not so good relations towards the Silicon Valley companies. I mean, you got a Mark Zuckerberg in the United States court.
I'm going to interrupt right here. That's Zuckerberg. That is
Zuckerberg.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. What have I said?
You said Zuckerberg. It's okay.
Zuckerberg. Okay, no, that's fine.
For people that don't know, obviously, Bruno is not a native English speaker, but it's okay.
No, yeah, in Portuguese, in Brazilian Portuguese, we call him Zuckerberg. It's totally different. No, that's it. I mean, we gotta have to more like, it's not a only government type of action. I mean, we have to involve the private sector as well because they created this all this environment and space to, which more far complex than the only like newspapers and TV shows. So, I mean, it's more like a permeated environment. We don't have rely on this old fashioned type of countermeasure, all this type of misinformation, fake news. Today is a far more different. Have the like a deep fake, which is, I mean, you can literally put like a person on Donald Trump face on a person face, and I mean, use the same voice tone, and like create a video say that, oh, China is going to invade, I mean, America tomorrow, be ready, be prepared. And I mean, there are people who believe this. So you got to be really smart. And I mean, as I said, there should be a coordination and cooperation among the private sector and the government sector, and especially the civil sector, because I mean, the most majority of actors who use this type of social media are people, are normal people. So I don't know how to do this. I know there is a lot of interest involved in this, but I don't see any easy way to cope with this type of a problem.
So Bruno, can you just restate what you said? So your concern is with social media? What was your
goal? No, it's like the problem that social media and information spreading, disinformation can create to the politics and public perception, opinion.
Okay, perfect. Now I understand. So yeah, that's definitely an interesting point with regards to disinformation. I don't know I definitely don't know. I can only imagine that with Bolsonaro, there's probably a large degree of misinformation going out. I think that is just the general trend with populist presidents. Like I was, you know, we had discussed the previous week, a lot of populists do rely on misinformation to try to win. And the that's definitely a very stressful reality with regards to with regards to deepfakes and with regards to just like the amount of power that individual hackers and, you know, Russian sometimes hackers can have over the elections and over the politics of different countries. Yeah, I guess as technology becomes smarter, we as people, you know, voters and as political actors in our own countries, we definitely need to become more smart at finding out the scams and the fake stuff. So it's going to be an escalating arms race of like...
Yeah, and I think, I mean, the type of action that, for example, if a hacker from Brazil create a big problem in the, I don't know, electricity system in the United States, what kind of action United States would take to counteract this will be like act against Brazil itself, against the President Bolsonaro, against the Brazilian internet. I mean, how the United States would track this guy or even the Brazilian ones. I mean, we shut down the whole system of internet just to find this guy. I don't know how to will be like the measures taken to punish this type of crime.
Yeah, what I would say is that the only way that we can really deal with this type of international threat with regards to technology is probably to strengthen, you know, UN and kind of like global cooperation to some degree. I think that is because the threats are not even just national, you know, at this point. They're from other countries. They're going to be from China. They're going to be from Russia. They're going to be from even probably some hackers in allied countries too. So it's going to be definitely something that we're going to all have to cooperate on in order to have some answers to. You know, there's definitely I'm definitely not the most tech savvy person to answer that question, but I'll bring it into my discussion where I'm also looking at other countries and kind of like what they're doing. Especially during this time of coronavirus, as the US unemployment rate soars under coronavirus to record highs, there are countries throughout the developed world that do not share the same experience. And Japan is the perfect example of a country that has its shit together with regards to the economic crisis spurred by the virus. The current US unemployment rate is around 8%, which is still bad, but it's not as bad as it was, you know, in April, where it was at about 15%, or very comparable to the Great Depression levels of unemployment. But the crazy thing is that Japan's unemployment rate has been pretty much stable at about 2.6%. Prior to the virus, it was about like 2.3. So it's only gone up by, you know, 0.3% during the entire coronavirus. So it's been relatively stable. And there are a couple of things that have been happening in Japan that might be a factor. One obvious difference, and this is probably the biggest factor, is just that Japan handled the virus a lot more effectively than the United States did. Japan, according to the New York Times, Japan, unlike the United States or China, has avoided a devastating spike in coronavirus cases, allowing it to keep more of its economy open. And it asked businesses to close on a voluntary basis during a state of emergency that lasted a month and a half and ended in May. But those differences only account for a small gap. So if it's not the coronavirus response that's the biggest factor, what is the big response? And I think the answer is cultural values to some degree. And these cultural differences between the US and Japan, and also planning to some degree, also a big factor. I think that the United States can learn quite a lot from what Japan has done. This is, I would consider the answer due to conservative policymaking, not conservative in the American political sense, but conservative in the sense that they planned ahead and they saved money. Japanese firms in times of plenty, unlike American firms, a lot of the times during a time of plenty, during the boom cycle, they will pay people more. Japanese firms do not do this. Japanese firms in times of plenty do not raise salaries exorbitantly high. Instead, they save the money and use it for times of crisis, which makes the employment much more stable. Japan is not an at-will employment state. So this is a big difference. This is something even I have dealt with quite, you know, a lot of Americans, unfortunately, we are at-will employment, which is basically if you sneeze at the wrong time, you can get fired. Whereas it's more difficult to fire employees it's a lot less difficult to fire employees in Japan. They simply have much more developed labor protections. And ultimately, you can summarize the differences between Japanese and American thinking with regards to labor as this: the Japanese actually care about their workers to some degree. The Americans usually only care about the shareholders, at least with regards to practice. Seeing as 99% of shares are owned by the wealthy in the United States, it would be safe to say that the U.S. culture about only caring about the very wealthy might be having some major repercussions broadly due to the pandemic. I would evaluate, and the crazy thing about valuing the stock market so much and valuing the shareholders so much as central to the way that Americans craft their policy is that there have been increases in the stock market, record increases in the stock market, despite all of this unemployment. So really, as unfortunate as this whole virus is, the practical reality is that not all Americans are in this together. We're just simply not. There are some Americans that are doing very well, and there are some Americans that are, you know, doing very poorly with the virus. And the I would evaluate another reason that Japan has a lower proclivity to fire its workers and, you know, less emphasis on the shareholders is because it actually has a social contract with its people. Social contract theory is the view that person's moral and or political obligations are dependent upon a contract or agreement among them to form the society in which they live. Japan has a culture, whereas the United States has an economy. To tackle the coronavirus is not an individualistic task. I'm also a firm believer that individualism is code for white supremacy to some degree. You can't segregate away minorities and have them deal with it. It is not the 1960s anymore. And and most neighborhoods are integrated in the United States. So if things are really bad for the African-American community or really bad for the Latino community, the virus is, there's no segregating these communities away from you anymore. They're going to be spreading it to your communities as well if you don't handle things. And there is a reason, there's going to be somebody in your grocery store that's probably packing the shelves. There's going to be, you know, people in your neighborhood. There is a reason that the White House has had more COVID cases than the country of New Zealand and Vietnam, like you were saying the previous discussion. What I would say is that the United States is handling the virus very much as if it was an economy and it was a society that it's just not today. Do you have any perspectives on this, Bruno? Seeing as I tied it heavily to the United States, I feel like maybe you don't have the most...
No, that's fine. I mean, because in Brazil, we got this type of thing, I think behavior, like people said that there are a lot of negationists here in Brazil. I mean, people who don't believe in the pandemic or anything else. I mean, they say that they don't need to use the mask. Like, it's all fake. It's a creation of the China economy to overcome something. I don't know how to say. And people, like, in these recent days, not the recent days, but I mean, in this recent week on the last month, people like started to go out as nothing's happening and really started to go to the bars, movies and parties. As the pandemic disappeared and still more than 500 people dying a day in Brazil. So, I mean, people started to normalize all this type of gravity and the type of, I mean, death has become a daily basis thing. Brazilian society has got along with like more than two airplanes falling, crashing the ground every single day. So, I mean,